This is Dana Lombardi at CelestaCon 2012, and we're here on Sunday at the Secrets of Borodino lecture with Frank Chadwick helping me on this panel discussion. And we actually, just to do a little quick overview, is that in a few days, it will be the 200th anniversary of the Battle of Borodino.
Mm-hmm.
No, big emphasis on no.
Borodino.
Borodino. And
yeah, that's the first secret,
right?
Is how to pronounce it.
All right, there's only three more after that. But we're going to discuss. I gave you a bunch of handouts that included a map that shows the general layout of the corps and divisions. And Frank had put together some points that he wanted to capture, including pronunciation on the first page, and then the rest of it is about a book. And the reason this came up is I didn't realize this book existed, but back in 1962, on the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Borodino, the Soviet government sent their archivists and historians into their document binge and looked up every one of these handwritten documents that they could find that related to the First and Second Western Armies and the Battle of Borodino. And they transcribed them into typewritten Russian, so it was readable. They also got rid of the four letters from the Russian alphabet they were still writing with back in 1812. So it's in modern Russian. And this book was sent to me in PDF form by somebody that said, well, you look at this. This is equivalent to like having the official records of the War of the Rebellion for the American Civil War. We don't have anything like this where we can have a pile of information about Napoleonic warfare that is primary source documentation in Russian, and I was able to coordinate a translation of it through a professor of Slavic languages who was born in Russia, was a little boy during the Great Patriotic War, and he translated it into English, and then another Russian-speaking person who was born in Georgia, Alexander Mikhailovitsa, who has written several books on the subject, was the editor. So he's sort of fine-tuned because he understands Napoleonic warfare and the Napoleonic period and has actually worked with these documents. He went through to help fine-tune the English, and then, of course, I and several other editors, including Janice back there, are going to go through and take their English and make it into American English. It was such an incredible opportunity about this book, and I have some sample pages in here that are in the Russian that you can see, and then the translation into English. And I'll go into that a little bit more after we talk about the battle itself. But Frank has already written an incredible campaign story about this that accompanied his La Bataille de Moskva, right?
The new edition of Clash of Arms version of La Bataille de Moskva.
Right, and it was... it's a really wonderful overview with a lot of good anecdotes and so forth. So what I would like to do is I want Frank to sort of bring us up to speed, if you don't mind. I don't want to spend the entire talk on Borodino itself, but it is important to put it in context to the campaign and why this is so big of a deal to have the battle. Go ahead, Frank.
Okay. I'm going to start off with my little pronunciation guide, just three words that usually get mispronounced. One is Borodino is actually pronounced Borodino. The accent is in the last syllable. Opolcheny, the Russian militia, is actually Opolcheny. And the commander of Second West Army, usually pronounced Bagration, is, and this is actually not quite right, it's not Bagration, it's Bagration.
Bagration.
The accent I get is in the last syllable.
Right.
So, pronunciation stuff. Now you can correct all your friends until they hate you. I'm going to cover a couple myths of the battle and of the campaign in general. I have five myths that are frequently mentioned about the Russian army that I think that don't really bear close examination. The first is that the Russian army was slow and sluggish in the way it maneuvered compared to the French, the nimble French and the ponderous Russians. And if you listen to some of the accounts of Russian units going into action, one of the things that's mentioned is how quickly Russian units moved in formation on the attack. One guy describing it like an avalanche, which does not fit our wargamer's perception of how slow and sluggish the Russian army was. Where did this myth come from? It comes from people looking at the march rate of the two armies. The French army in combat maneuvered at the pas de charge of 120 paces per minute. The Russian army in combat maneuvered at the skoryi zag of about 105 paces a minute, which means, the French move like 20 to 25% faster than the Russians, right? The problem with that is that the French pace was only 26 inches and the Russian pace was 30 inches. So if you multiply 120 paces per minute by 26 inches for the French, you get a rate of 260 feet per minute was the advance rate of a French unit. If you multiply the Russian pace rate of 105 paces per minute times 30 inches, their advance rate was 262.5 feet per minute. The Russians were actually marginally faster than the French once you take into account the fact that their pace rate was longer, which most people in wargaming for years and years didn't. They figured a pace is a pace is a pace, but all armies had a different pace rate, a different pace length at the time. So, Russian army was just as maneuverable, just as quick, just as nimble on the battlefield as the French, at least in that respect. The second thing you hear, there's two divisions of combined grenadiers in the Russian army. This is a separate from the divisions of actual standing grenadiers, but there were two divisions that were formed at the beginning of the campaign by combining the grenadiers from all the depot battalions of the regiments. And it is often claimed that these were not really very good troops, because they were, after all, the scrapings of the depots. And, you know, the impression is that the depot troops are, you know, the old men and the boys and the cast-offs of these regiments. The truth is there were no depot units in the Russian army until the beginning of the 1812 campaign. Every Russian infantry regiment consisted of three battalions. They were all the same. At the beginning of the 1812 campaign, recognizing that there would be a need to keep some depth and send replacements forward, the 2nd Battalion of every infantry regiment was designated the depot. It was just like all the other battalions. It's just that when the regiment marched in the field, it only took the 1st and 3rd Battalion, and the 2nd Battalion stayed behind. Now, there was some shuffling of troops, so if there were people who were sick and couldn't march with the regiment, they were shifted to the 2nd Battalion and healthy troops were shifted to the 1st. But in terms of experience level and training level and everything else, there's no difference between that regimental depot battalion and the others. That depot then would later provide reinforcements, and that they formed the depot or replacement battalions, the reserve battalions of the regiments. But the Russians decided that they couldn't afford to keep the grenadier companies of those battalions out of the action. That although they needed replacements, they didn't want to use grenadiers as a replacement holding unit. So they stripped all these grenadier companies, which were exactly the same and just as good as the line units, and made these two converged grenadier divisions. There were some other converged grenadier battalions that were used on the flanks in the army in the north and the south as reserve units, but in the center they converged them into two, the 1st and 2nd converged grenadier divisions. One of them, the 1st Division, which was with the 1st West Army, was part of the 5th Corps, which was the Guard Corps. And that 5th Corps consisted of the Foot Guard Division, the 1st Combined Grenadier Division, which were these guys, and the 1st Cuirassier Division, which was about half made up of the Guard Heavy Regiments. So the Guard Corps, you know, half of it was the Combined Grenadier Division. It was pretty good. 2nd West Army got the 2nd Combined Grenadier Division. Those are the guys that hold the flashes during the Battle of Borodino. And they basically fight to their own extinction. It is a credit to how violent the fighting was for the flashes that we really don't know how many times the flashes changed hands. It just got so confused and so violent. There was so much. The French would take it, and the Russians would, and this combined grenadier would take it back. The French would take it, and they'd take it back. They just kept launching counterattack and counterattack until finally there were probably fewer than 1,000 guys with the colors when the division finally just kind of winked out of existence. But in the process, one of the achievements of this division was they routed the French 57th Foot. I don't know if you know any, those of you who are Napoleonic buffs know that the best line regiment in the French army was the terrible 57th. I mean, they were just a famous regiment. Everybody thinks they're as good as the Guard and better than some of the Guard. And they actually were routed out of the flashes by a counterattack from the 2nd Combined Grenadier Division. So the Combined Grenadiers really were really plenty good troops. Third myth, the Russian army at Borodino was filled up with green recruits at the last minute because 15,000 reserve troops showed up and were assigned to the unit to replace losses and straggling. Most of those troops were reserve battalions, which were the depot battalions of those regiments. And the depot battalions were every bit as good as the line troops. They were exactly the same troops. Then they got there, and they were very welcome replacements. I mean, if you look at the strength of the Russian army, their infantry strength, the regular infantry strength at Borodino was about 73,000 regulars, of which about 15,000 arrived shortly before the battle. So big difference in terms of the strength. So probably they had about 60,000, and they got about 13,000 infantry and about 2,000 reserve cavalry. So there were certainly troops that showed up at the last minute, but they were not green, inexperienced recruits. And by the way, there was these reserve battalions, and then there were also the recruit or replacement battalions, which were less trained. They were from the main recruit training centers, and every regiment had a recruit battalion, I think it was called, which was the 4th battalion, which came from these big combined replacement training centers. But those guys actually weren't that bad in terms of training either. I mean, the Russians had a remarkably thorough training system. When you went into the Russian army, that you went to one of these recruit training centers and you got 9 months of training. I mean, compared to like most of the French army at this time, I think, you know, that you get your uniform and then as you're marching to the front, you learn how to march. And in the afternoon, you stop and shoot a couple rounds, and that's kind of your training. I mean, you kind of learned on your way to the front. Or sometimes in a National Guard battalion. These guys got 9 months of very intensive and pretty methodical training. I mean, it dealt with small unit actions, it dealt with marksmanship. Towards the end, it was survival on bivouac and how to forage and how to, you know, make fires and stuff like that. So, pretty thorough training. Fourth myth, and this, boy, you hear this one a lot, that the Russian reserve artillery was not committed at Borodino, that the Russians tied up a whole bunch of their artillery in this silly reserve thing that they had, and then Kutaisov, the commander, went dashing over the front and got killed, and so none of these guns got into action. And sometimes you hear figures of like 200 and some guns in the reserve artillery. There's a couple problems with this myth. The first is that mostly people count the reserve artillery before 2 days before the Battle of Borodino, which was before the Battle of Shevardino. At the Battle of Shevardino, which was the initial kind of outlying action, which took place 2 days earlier, once that action was resolved, the Russians had a day to kind of retool. And when they did, they shifted some weight to their left flank, and they shifted a lot of the guns out of the reserve artillery up into the positions around Semenovskaya and the flashes. So, actually, on the day of Borodino, out of 624 guns in the Russian army, they had 150 in reserve. Of those, 120 were in 1st West Army, which was the reserve under Kutaisov. The other 30 or so were in the 2nd West Army, in their reserve, and they mostly got into action. But the 120 that were in reserve under Kutaisov, that's 10 batteries of 12 guns each, consisted of 8 horse batteries, not 8 horse batteries. They have 5 horse batteries, 2 position batteries, and 3 light batteries. The horse batteries almost certainly got into action fairly quickly by the time Kutaisov died. And by the end of the action, almost everything that wasn't pushed forward got into action because the battle came to the reserve. And that was the last gun line that stopped the Russian, the French advance. Just as the sun was going down. But here's some interesting numbers. Here are the 10 batteries. I won't tell you the designations of the batteries, but I'll just tell you their loss rates from the Russian records. Okay, this is the percentage losses the 10 batteries of the reserve that supposedly never got into action suffered at Borodino. First Light, well, I will tell you that. First Lightfoot battery took 10%. Second Lightfoot battery took 10%. Fifth Lightfoot battery took 30% casualties out of its personnel at Borodino. Fourth Horse battery, 15%. Fifth Horse battery, 50% casualties at Borodino. 29th position battery, 20%. 30th position battery, 10%. 9th horse battery, 95% casualties at Borodino. 10th horse battery, 95% casualties, and the 22nd horse battery, 10%. So, I mean, clearly, these at least about half the batteries in the reserve were pretty heavily engaged and took really heavy casualties. Fifth myth, artillery, Russian artillery was ineffective due to bad powder. I don't even know what to say about this. I mean, this strikes me as an excuse that someone came up for how the Russians could have lost with all this artillery. But the I don't know that the Russian artillery is that much worse than anybody else's at this time. It's a little worse. It's interesting that it was probably vastly superior to the quality of powder the French had in 1814. I mean, it was notoriously bad. But nobody wants to down-check French artillery that much in 1814. I think people just kind of look for excuses to down-check the Russians. And it strikes me that by the Battle of Borodino, I think a lot of the French batteries were using captured French powder by then anyway. And nobody seems to want to talk about, you know, and these batteries must have been bad too because they had captured French powder. So that's my five Russian myths. A couple comments on the intensity of the battle, which I think is unprecedented and really worth looking at. First is the unprecedented level of noise. I mean, Borodino was a fairly geographically confined battlefield, and the troops were really packed in, and there was a pretty intensive fighting over the course of the battle.
You might want to take a look at your map helps show that, because it is compact.
It's very compact. Very compact battlefield for the number of guys.
I knew you would ask that. This is how far do you think?
He's talking about this in lunch. Where's the compass road?
Yeah.
Does this represent about a mile, 2 miles?
Let's see. No, it's more than that. It's probably about
4 miles.
Probably about 4 miles
by two
this
and a half.
Way by about two and a half or 3 miles.
Right, and Gettysburg as a comparison, is what?
Gettysburg, if you take the whole battlefield, is it's somewhat larger, but not a huge amount larger than this. It's Gettysburg is. Let me see. I'm trying to think. I have to convert from.
I don't know. They're facing each other across. When you're standing on Little Round Top, you can see the woods across where Pickett is going a mile away, right? So the actual area where the two armies are fighting across this mile gap, okay? So counting the area right behind, you've got, say it's 2 miles wide. It's very long, and it goes in a fish hook, but it's 2 miles thick. Okay, and it goes 4 miles.
Usually, when you have to scrunch the I have to go in volley and bayonet terms because that's how I usually set these things up. But if you scrunch a little bit, you can fit Gettysburg on about a 6x12 table.
Okay,
and on volley and bayonet, every 18 inches is a mile. So 6 feet across is about 4 miles.
Okay.
4 by 8, and that's got a lot of maneuver around the edges. You know, the classic footprint map you see of Gettysburg from all 3 days. I mean, that's got all 3 days fighting.
Right.
Is about it's probably about 4 by 6 or 4 by 8.
So miles. These are very similar.
Very similar.
They've got at least they have 120,000 on each side, roughly, say here. So
over 120,000 on each side.
Right. So it's almost 250,000 men for Borodino. No, as opposed to Gettysburg, where Lee had 90,000 and the Army of Potomac had... Right, so you're talking about at least 50% more guys?
Well, I don't know, at least 50%, but you have more guys, and all of Borodino takes place in 1 day. I mean, that's the only thing. They're not straggling in. There's not multiple commitments at different parts of the battlefield. Everybody's there.
Right.
And they just go at it hammer and tongs all day long. And that accounts for the real intensity here. Let me give you some numbers. Each side expended approximately 60,000 cannon rounds and 1 million musket cartridges over the course of this one day of the battle, which means, although the intensity rose and fell over the course of the battle, the average was 3 cannon shots and 50 musket shots per second over the course of the battle, per second. And so you have people talking about the intent, the quality of the sound, which was that at the most intense parts of the battle, you couldn't distinguish cannon shots. One officer said that it sounded like an orchestra of kettle drums beating their drums as fast as you could. Another one sounded like, it didn't sound like individual discharges. It sounded like 120 gun ships of the line firing broadsides. Russian staff officer rode across the battlefield, the length of the battlefield where there was a lot of artillery going on. When he got to the other side, he couldn't speak and he could not close his mouth because he was suffering from concussion from the passage the passage of artillery rounds over his head. The one guy was watching the area around the Raevsky Redoubt, and he said it looked like, among other things, with all the musket fire and canister fire, by the end of the battle, all the grass was gone and it was bare dirt in most of the areas. And he said it looked like there were little whirlwinds all across the glacis of this, and he finally realized that those were individual canister rounds hitting and kicking up dirt, almost continuously. So enormous intensity. There were a lot of people, a lot of Russian officers have written memoirs, and they talk about, and some of them were, this was their first battle. And they went through the Battle of Borodino and assumed this is what battles were like. You know, all battles are like this, right? And then he said, this one guy in particular said that he fought all the way through the 1813 campaign and the 1814 campaign, and he said that after Borodino, the battles were just like exercises. They were enormously non-violent compared to what he was expecting. After he thought, God, it's always like this. This is horrible. But actually, it's not so bad. So that's an unprecedented noise. Unprecedented casualties for a single day of battle. It's the bloodiest single day of the Napoleonic Wars. Waterloo is second. But Borodino is the bloodiest single day of the Napoleonic Wars, and it is bloodier. More people die the single day of Borodino than died in any single day of World War I, including the first day of the Battle of the Somme. And there are twice as many people involved in the first day of the Battle of the Somme than there are at Borodino. There's a total of about 250,000 people involved at Borodino. There's about 500,000 people involved at the Somme, and the casualties at Borodino are slightly higher than at the Somme, which means that the casualty rate at Borodino was about twice the rate suffered at the first day of the Somme. Now, since a disproportionate number of casualties were suffered by the British at the first day of the Battle of the Somme, both sides at Borodino suffered a casualty rate about the same as the British Army suffered in the first day of the Battle of Somme, which everybody considers a grotesque, an unprecedented grotesque massacre. It wasn't unprecedented. Borodino was worse. Borodino was worse. And the third note is that the intensity of one of the things that gets ignored about the intensity of the battle and all the talk about losses is that the French cavalry was destroyed at Borodino. The French cavalry, they went in with about 28,000 cavalry, a little less, of which 4,000 were the guard cavalry who were not committed. So there was 24,000 cavalry committed to the Battle of Borodino. They lost 15,000 cavalry horses during the course of that one day. So their cavalry, their line cavalry, started off with about 28,000. By the end of the battle, was reduced to 9,000 men, which is one of the reasons there was no pursuit afterwards. It was also one of the reasons that the retreat became such a rout, is that the French just didn't have cavalry after that. I got some notes on strength, but we can hold that if you want.
What I'd like to do is go back a step, because we talked about some things on the battle that I think are very important for people to understand, and I appreciate your overview, because that really sets it the battle in context to other battles in particular. But a couple of things about the campaign in general, and I just want to step back, is that this was really a shock to the Russians, because the last time Russia had ever been invaded was Charles XII of Sweden at the beginning of the 19th century. So you're talking about, there was no one...
Not the 19th century.
It's 18th century, 1705, I think. Anyway, so there was no one living in Russia who remembered that, because it was so long ago. And therefore, Russia, unlike other parts of Europe, I mean, France had been invaded, you know, had been repeatedly invaded. Germany was, like, all through, you know, history, and recent history, too, had been overrun. And Russia had been relatively untouched in a lot, these people's lifetime. So this invasion was psychologically a huge thing to them, and why it was important in their propaganda, and why it became the First Patriotic War, and the other one became the Great Patriotic War. But one of the things about this is also that they thought from the beginning that they were going to do we're going to give territory, because we're not going to try and fight at the border. That was part of the intended strategy, is to give, and they try to morph that into the entire campaign was thought this way, keep sucking them deeper and deeper into Russia. But they never thought it was going to go as far as it did. They truly thought they were going to end up having fighting before Smolensk. So they were not prepared as well as they would have been, with depots for ammunition and everything else, as far deep as that, because they had anticipated fighting the battles sooner than that. There are a lot of reasons why it didn't happen. Their armies avoided getting trapped and encircled by Napoleon, who was very frustrated. And so when it came to the battle, and his marshals were arguing for a flanking move, don't go straight up the middle, go around the right or the left or whatever, Napoleon was adamant about hitting the Russians when he could. He couldn't foresee how bloody it was going to be, or the fact that his force was also going to be just as beaten up as badly. But he needed to, in his mind, inflict a serious defeat on the Russian army, because up to this point, they'd always escaped having a major battle, and they were still intact. Like a fleet in being, his army's still intact. Alexander's not going to negotiate or give in as long as he's got an army that can keep fighting. And Napoleon... It was just concerned that if he tried another maneuver around their flanking, they would work, and they would just simply abandon the position. There's no reason to stay at Borodino.
It's almost certain they would have, by the way.
Yes, yeah.
Almost certain.
Yeah.
Kutuzov would have pulled back if
right.
He wanted to try to flank.
But Napoleon felt he could destroy their army. He felt that he was so confident that he could pull this off, that if they were going to give him the opportunity, it's like, okay, fine. You know, because as Frank has said, it's unprecedented, the amount of destruction and the amount of artillery shells and everything that was going to be thrown into this area. And the Russian army suffered tremendously from it. I mean, they were just going to... And it wasn't just overall. It wasn't even... The numbers I've seen, and part of it's reinforced from this book that I'm going to tell you a little bit about... 75% of the Russian officer corps becomes casualties at this battle. 75%. There are regiments of infantry commanded by lieutenants. They're the highest ranking guys left. Okay? One of the reasons that Kutuzov decides to retreat is simply because, not because they're not holding the territory, they actually reoccupy a lot of the fleshes and the other things, because...
Mm-hmm. They reoccupy the Great Redoubt after nightfall.
Right, and one of the reasons for that is that they're open the wrong direction. They're a fortification that points the wrong way, so there's no reason for the French to sit there other than to prevent the Russians from, you know, occupying it. So they abandon it, and the Russians reoccupy it. So in their minds, on that level, they've won the battle because they've stopped the French. They have the same territory as they did, but when Kutuzov is looking at the numbers and he's trying to figure out who's going to control the army, who's going to actually carry out the orders being sent down the line and everything, there's almost no one there. So that's one of the reasons that they decide to not only retreat, but it also influences the fact that they're not going to fight in front of Moscow And there are other factors, but it's one of the factors that comes into, you know, we're just not going to fight for the city. Well, it'd be better to abandon it because we still haven't lost our army, and losing the army is far worse than losing the city. Strategically, I think the Russians have a much better grasp than Napoleon. I think he always felt he could win on the battlefield, and that would allow him to negotiate from strength rather than use diplomacy or other things to influence it. And although he inflicted more casualties on the Russians than his army suffered, his were devastatingly important, as Frank has pointed out, particularly among the cavalry. And so just to put it into context, one of the things that we know, of course, is that he's going to capture Moscow. Alexander is, partly because of the battle, is going to be strong instead of being a weak monarch, not negotiate with Napoleon, and Napoleon fatally delays his retreat. He's not clairvoyant. He has no idea when the winter is going to hit, but he knows it's going to hit, and he's moving into winter quarters, and it's not fast enough. And we can debate whether, you know...
Let me jump in one thing here, and that is on this issue of casualties. And remember, it's Napoleon who says the moral is to the physical as 3 is to 1. So it's not... the attrition that suffered there is enormously important, but it's not the only thing that's important.
Right.
And there's a couple things that the Russians do, to a certain extent inadvertently, which catapult this into a moral victory. One of them is not inadvertent. It's despite the enormous casualties the Russians suffer there, the Russian army never breaks at Borodino. It's either pushed back very grudgingly, or the units are annihilated in place, like the 2nd Grenadier, Combined Grenadier Division. They just die in place. There's never any time when the line seems to give way. Right. Which is kind of the decisive moment in these battles, and that just never happens. I mean, this army never buckles, and so the next day they're not going to be capable of doing much because of the loss in officer casualties. But they never get that moral that sense that they're really beaten by Napoleon because they never buckle on the day. Then they withdraw at night, which is enormously important because I think it's been argued fairly persuasively that the Russians don't understand the scope of their own casualties on an elemental level because they leave at night and they never really see the battlefield. They never see how many dead and wounded Russians there are littering this battlefield, which they would have seen if they'd stuck around yes. until the next morning.
And I think that's deliberate, too. I think that the night retreat is deliberate, not only because, you know, not to prevent a pursuit, but I think that is part of it because Kutuzov knows what the losses are.
So if the Russian army sticks around for another day and sees how they've been gutted, it's going to be a different psychological effect on that army than they have, which... They fight all day. They never buckle. They take the worst, everything that Napoleon can throw at them, and never buckle. And then at night they withdraw because they, you know, to new positions. And so they have a psychological advantage that's delicate, but it's important.
It's very important. And I think you're right. Napoleon always felt like the psychological, the morale is the physical. It's 3 is to 1. And that's what you're trying to do is inflict. You're trying to get the other side to believe that you are more powerful, more skillful, and so forth. It's one of the reasons why when they knew Napoleon was in the field, they felt like he's worth 40,000 men. So there's a psychological, it's like going up against somebody that statistically it looks like, well, we're about even, you know. But no, you know, this guy is really good and we have to be nervous. There's a thing that's I would like to come back to what if, because I love what ifs, and what ifs are why I play war games. And one of the biggest what ifs that Napoleon turned down is at what Ney and some of the others felt was a turning point in the battle. They're begging him to release at least a portion of the guard. Okay, like you said, the guard cavalry is not in it, the young guard is not in it, even the Vistula Legion is not in it because they're being treated like guard, and the old guard, of course, is not going to be used. He's saying at least release the young guard. Because they are like on that edge where we feel that they could shatter. This one last blow will do it. Now we can debate whether that would happen or not, okay? But the fact is Napoleon doesn't do it because he can't see. I mean, the fog of war truly is on this battlefield because of the sheer amount of ammunition. So there's so much that's covering the area. In fact, this happens at Gettysburg, by the way. The 11th Corps Artillery, which is out on Cemetery Hill, at where the cemetery itself is, Osborne just stops them shooting. He says, "You're going to hit your own men." He says, "We have no idea what we're shooting at. There's so much smoke right now covering the battle." He says, "Stop." He just says, "Stop shooting." So until the smoke goes out of the way, I can see what we've got, because we have no idea what we're actually shooting at. We're obviously wasting ammunition shooting at the enemy because we don't know we're hitting them. And somebody, we could be literally hitting guys that could be crossing in front of us. Yes, Joe?
That kind of brings up a question that occurred to me that I wanted to ask is, given the sound level on this battlefield and the chaos that's going on the front lines, what was command like? Because as soon as it seems to me that once you got within a quarter of a mile of the front lines, the sound and the fact that you're sending couriers in, but you're just literally sending them to a maelstrom, and whether they come back in time or not, how is they? Are people just launching forces into the battle and then just saying, well, what happens, happens, because we have no control once they get in there?
Well, pretty much, yes. I mean, the control you have is when you commit them,
right,
and where you commit them. But once they're committed, there's not a lot of fine finesse fiddling going on in there.
Because when you play Borodino in Clash of Arms or Mars Modernizes game, you're sitting there constantly fiddling with this guy in square, put this guy, and it seems like, it almost seems that at a certain level of the game, those units are going to do what they do to survive anyway. There shouldn't be any, let's fiddle with this or let's fiddle with that. It should be like, okay, you can make the roll to see if you go in square of cavalry, because that's what the guys would try to do naturally anyway and stuff. But when you're gaining this choice to say, quick, put them in line, because we can generate a whole bunch of firepower, and then now put them in the assault, it's like, is that way too much control that anyone really would have had?
I think that's an excellent question. I personally think that the hardest decision to make in game design is what level you're putting the player at, and what you do to keep him at that level, and not let him. But and you get to break that. In a perfect world, you would just have one level of command, and you'd fiddle with that level. The truth is that in order to make the game fun, you let them fiddle lower, because that's where some interesting stuff's going on. But if you do too much of that, if you've got somebody commanding an army and a corps and a division and a brigade, and they're fiddling regiments into battalions and stuff, yeah, you're probably letting them fiddle too much, and you're giving them too much control. And I would, Marshall Enterprise does. Clash of Arms does great stuff. They're very well researched. And people love the games. That's probably not the way I do it. I think those things, if you're going to try to do the whole battle, you're better off with your basic maneuver element, a higher echelon than battalions and regiments, because you don't really have much control down there. If you've also got the control up here of when you're going to commit them and how they're going to go in and stuff like that, it's perfectly appropriate if you're fighting just kind of the brigade commander's point of view.
When the units were in the fliches, the redoubts and stuff, what form of formation were they in? Just mixed order, or because obviously they couldn't be an assault column if you're occupying.
Actually, my understanding is that mostly they were, that the artillery was actually in the fliches.
Yeah.
There's the three arrow shaped redoubt. Each one of those has a 12 gun battery of Russian artillery. Some may have like a battery and a half.
Right.
Mostly that's what's occupying the entrenchment, and then the infantry supports are in attack column back.
Okay.
And so if the French get into the flashes, then these attack columns of grenadiers from the 2nd Combined Grenadier Division would go in and counterattack and throw them out, and then help the gunners get reestablished, and then they'd kind of pull back into reserve, and the guns were using there. And there were probably some troops in extended order. They throw a company forward in close support, they'd be in extended order spread among the guns.
Yeah, that's all. What I'd like to do just is move into this book and the reason why I'm so excited about this book. I mean, this is, now you'll hear a commercial, okay? This is the page from the book, and this is way oversized. It's not. It's more of a what do they call that? The
digest size trade paperback?
Yes, that's sort of smaller size. This is a blow up, and then I've also given you the English version of this, so you can see what it says. This one's easy, but now what kind of orders are in here? Well, what they did is they numbered them. This is not the number, historical number. This is the document number that the Soviets historians gave it because it chronologically fell that way, okay? Mm-hmm. And so you can see that number 3 is number 3 document, whereas the document itself is number 18, and it says the date August 11th, which is not our August 11th. Which way did it
Gregorian
go?
Gregorian calendar,
right, which is like behind? Behind by 11
the
days
Julian
or something?
Is it Julian or the Gregorian? I forget which one.
13 days by the
right.
The October Revolution, so...
Which is, by the way, why there was a misunderstanding between the Austrians and the Russians, because the Russians told the Austrians they were going to be at Austerlitz, I think, at a certain date, and so the Austrians are going, it's well past that date. Where are the Russians? And it's like, no, the Russians think they're on time because, guess what? They're using a different calendar, right? So now this order is not hugely, critical. I mean, I used one here that was not. Earth-shaking. But the reason I picked it is because there is a note down at the bottom that the Soviet historians have put in, okay? So you can see that these are not just, here's a bunch of orders, you figure it out, okay? It also includes footnotes by the Soviet historians and others so that you understand what the heck they're talking about or who these people are. And that's really important. What's exciting to me, and Frank, I imagine, too, is that if you look at this one, which is document number 159, English here, the smaller one, is that you have really good, as Frank was saying about the numbers, this is where we get some of these numbers. And what I think is interesting is if you look at the top, where it says killed, wounded, and missing, okay, do you notice it says charger horses, okay? Horses that were ridden by cavalry units like hussars and cuirassiers and so forth, they're chargers, okay? Mm-hmm. There are also artillery horses. It's another category. You see that in the artillery thing. And you also have draft horses, which will pull any kind of a wagon. You can't just hop on a horse and ride off with it. Well, you can try it, but cavalry horses have to be trained in battle for all the maneuvers and everything they have to do, as well as the noise and factor and being shot at. And so it's a little interesting tidbit that we leave these words that mean something specific. And notice there are even non-combatants. It's like, what? What are these non-combatants, right? It's like, yes, there were civilians.
These are cavalry units.
Yes.
So I would expect that the non-combatants are not necessarily civilians, but they're like...
farriers and things like that?
Farriers, clerks, paymasters,
right.
Doctor,
right.
Surgeon, veterinarians.
Right. And it's interesting that there are killed, wounded, and missing in that. Okay? Mm-hmm. So... The Russian army is a very organized administrative army that has lots of good charts and diagrams, and they fill these in. These guys are meticulous, you know. These are not just, running around like in the Middle Ages saying we have a million of that, and we cat a million dead, and we killed a million guys, right? I mean, they're very precise. And so this gives us a window into the Russian army in 1812 that I think is really, really useful and fascinating. Now, what I did not do is, and I wish I had done this for you, there are two more parts to this book. One are all the awards that were given, and not just what they were, but it says what unit, who in the unit got it, including down to privates and so forth, and what they did to get that award.
Oh, the citation.
Yes, the citation.
Nice.
It's abbreviated, but it's like here's hundreds and hundreds of awards given to guys, whether it posthumously or whether they got it for other reasons. And so you have a whole section that tells you these anecdotes about the battle, about brave acts done by different units, and it's like, holy cow. Things that you wouldn't always pick up in memoirs and other things, but somebody saw it and was able to, get that up the chain of command so that a award could be given. And then the final section is about, I'd say, a dozen officers who wrote after-action reports. not full memoirs, but these reports are then combined into a narrative. So an order is an order, a letter or a report is one thing, but the after-action reports, you know, give a little bit of more opinion and things by officers who survived, you know, are wounded and survived, right? And so this book is just, it's about 416 pages. What we've done is we put, like, we're going to have color maps at the front so that you can see who was where, what they were. We're going to have the division numbers on it so you know what the division's number and the corps numbers. And also, we're going to color code whether the guy was wounded or killed so you know the division commander. And you can see just how intense the battle was, because there was a, like 100 generals on both sides who end up being killed or wounded or captured. It's just astonishing. Just, you know, it's like a slug match and neither side is giving in, you know? And I think you're right, that absolutely, that the Russian army came away from it. And the reason it has been built up as a victory and it's still taught as a victory is because of the psychological victory that they won by not being defeated. In other words, they won by not being routed. In fact, Kutuzov even says that in one of his things, to his letter to his wife, where he says, I kept almost all my artillery. In other words, a sign of being routed, a sign of being destroyed as an army is that you have to retreat off the battlefield so fast that a lot of artillery is lost to the enemy. And that's a sign of humiliation, as well as the fact it's the hardest number you can show. But he was able to get away with all but maybe 10% of his artillery. So this is huge to him. And I think rightfully so from his perspective, because he was expecting to have a harder time of it. Which brings up the next what if in my mind. Okay, so the guard...
Well, did we finish the first what if?
No, we didn't. I don't think.
So he couldn't, right?
What would have happened? Would they have gone in? In other words, and that depends where he would have sent them. If he just orders them straight into the fog, who knows what they would have run into? If he orders them on a flank attack, where you know there's this wide open left, right, where Uvarov and the Platov and the Cossacks charge in and then turn around and charge back, or over on the right where Poniatowski's corps is like, you know, pushing back and forth with the third corps of Tuchov's, mm-hmm. Would that have made a difference? If so, how much of a difference would that have caused the rest of the Russian army, if they even were aware of it? Because, again, you can't even see beyond your own area. Even Kutuzov couldn't see any more than Napoleon. So would a breakthrough been have been possible? Would it have made a difference? Would it meant that the Russians are just pushed back on one flank or another, or in the middle further back than they were? I mean, this is a debate that could go on forever, but I mean, I'm interested in your opinion on this, Frank.
In my opinion, I think it is a difficult one to sort out as to what the immediate effect on the battle would be, but I think the long-term effect of, you know, when Napoleon says this, I won't have my guard destroyed, what is 1,000 leagues from Paris,
right,
or something.
Right.
And I think he's absolutely right. I think that if Napoleon commits his guard at Borodino, he personally, physically, is a dead man. Because if you look at the retreat from Russia, by the time you get to the Berezina, the only thing left is the guard in terms of a formed body.
And keeping the rest of the army organized, because there is still some...
They're the core.
They're the core that's reliable.
Yeah, I mean, the other corps have one or two battalions.
You know, like, right, right.
The guard is the bulk of the formed army by
right.
the time they get to the Berezina. And that's what, and it's able to push a hole that Napoleon is able to physically,
right.
personally
right.
escape.
Yes.
without the guard, if the guard gets chopped at Borodino, Napoleon's not getting out of Russia himself.
Right.
But that's my opinion.
Well, and I think that historically, because we know he's going to retreat and he's going to almost get trapped and he has to break out the Berezina, we know that's going to happen, and the guard is able to help him, whatever remnants of the army are ever going to get out of Russia, and the fact he personally is going to be able to escape back to France and rebuild everything, absolutely true. What historians are arguing about is it wouldn't have made a difference, because that wouldn't have happened, if the guard committed destroyed the bar. If that was the thing that broke the straw that broke the camel's back, if that causes the rout and everything else so that it collapses at that point, all right, then the argument is Alexander is going to treat with them because he doesn't have that moral victory on his side. But there's another little what if in there. Okay?
Let me talk about that just briefly, and I will give you an anecdote from history, different anecdote. And that is when Philip of Macedon is overrunning most of Greece.
Yes.
It's Alexander. When he's fighting all the revolts after Philip is killed, he goes down and he overruns most of Greece. And the Spartans are nominally in revolt against him, at least not owing him allegiance. And he sends the Spartans a message. And the message is, if my army marches on Sparta, and if my and defeats the Spartan army, I will destroy the city of Sparta. I will leave no brick on top. I will sell the women into slavery. I'll execute all the men, and I will see that the name of Sparta is removed from all annals and will never spoken again. And the Spartan answer is one word: if.
Yes.
There's a lot of ifs.
There is a lot of ifs in this, which is why I think Napoleon, again, when we play war games, that's the end of the world. When the last turn is over, right? So we play for that. So I want that victory hex. If I lose my entire army and I get the victory hex, I've won the game, and I have bragging rights for the rest of the evening. But the reality is, in history, you've just destroyed your army.
That's right.
Right,
now you have to go home. But at Borodino. And when you said that, the meet and greet, I thought that was just the way people from Illinois said that. milk or beers or let's go visit the Sears Tower.
Park the car. Right?
In Boston, right.
Boston. Yeah, exactly. Right. But I know what you're saying. The same thing. Well, there's one more.
But my question, Napoleon actually he starts his Russian campaign with 450,000 men. Mm-hmm. And he's already lost two-thirds of his men through attrition.
Well, mostly through detachment, not attrition. There's a whole army in the south. There's a whole army in the north.
The
attrition is when winter hits and they all die of starvation. But he's already seen his army trickle away.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, they're not dead yet.
Right. They're not dead yet.
Yeah, they still have another 3 months to live. Thank you, Mr. Emperor. So he's already seen his army trickle away. And if he allows the Russians to, if he flanks the Russians, allow them to withdraw, they'll just trickle again to the point where he's actually attacking not from a position of numerical superiority or even numerical parity. He's actually having to fight the Russians
with an inferiority.
Doesn't that make his case of finally bringing these guys to battle compelling?
It does, I think, and that's why he doesn't give in to Davout's and Poniatowski's urging to flank them. But I think at the same time, there's no way to prove this, but I think at the same time that when he gets, by the time Ney and these guys are coming to him and saying, oh, come on, just give us another division and we're going to crack these guys, I think he's already, on a certain level, realized the jig is up. That he should have stopped at Smolensk and gone into winter quarters. But he thought that, he kind of gets talked to him, we're just going to make this big dash, and we're going to catch these guys, and one more blow, and it's all going to come down. One more attack, we'll just get these guys, and once the last domino falls, everybody's going to collapse. And I think at this point, by the afternoon of Borodino, I think Napoleon, my gut feeling is he's realizing this, nothing is going right, and this grasping at straws is how everything is going to come out wonderfully if we do this. I think he's already thinking in terms of covering his bets in the event things go wrong. I got some hands up in the air, too. Look back there first, and then...
Game of Emperors, Court of Kings. Tabletop games are for kings. And empires stage wars, campaigns for fun at times. Isn't that an instrument?
Certain
people claim to have the best weapons and the most disciplined armies and so on, but the time changes things.
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Imperial war games.
I'm not familiar with Imperial war games.
Okay.
Are you talking about a game company?
No, not the modern games. I mean, traditional empires, playing in one-to-one skill, killing.
You mean the game of kings.
The game of kings.
War and conquest.
So, but what's your question? I mean, I guess I don't understand the point you're trying to make.
Is that any of that in your research?
You mean that this is just a game of kings and that the people don't matter? That, you know, if I ended up killing everybody I've got, all I want to do is keep enough of my personal guard.
Duties of office, but don't emperors get their jollies off sending armies to capture things?
Probably. Sure.
But they want to succeed.
Yeah. But they want to succeed, yeah.
Yeah. So. I mean, they're not going to just, let's go get a bunch of people killed.
No, there was a purpose in this.
Some of them are like,
From our point of view, there's a whole lot of psychotic bastards.
To his credit, Alexander was able to be convinced to go back to St. Petersburg and not lead the army in the field, which he wanted to at the beginning of the campaign, which could have ended up in a true disaster. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay, so back to that what if. To me, the thing I want to know, more than you can answer, is two points. What is in and what is behind the Rebsky Redoubt at the moment he's asked to commit the guard? So that ties into what likelihood is there a chance of actually breaking the center? And then number two, how strongly do you feel one way or the other that Alexander would have said, we need to negotiate if his army, that army at least, is effectively destroyed?
Oh, he's in deep trouble, okay? I mean, he was already in trouble with his court. And keep in mind, you have to remember this, his father was assassinated, okay? It's like the court was unhappy with dad, and they had him killed, and they came to him and said, you're now the new czar.
Right.
So they were not going to hesitate, you know, to kill him if they're not happy with him. And they're not happy right now because it's not going well. Bagration and Barclay are not playing nice together. There you have the two main armies. The other big army is still tied up with the Turks, I think, at this point.
Well,
isn't
yeah,
it?
There's what York is up in the north with the army built around First Corps,
right?
And Admiral with Tichagov.
Yeah.
But actually, by this time, the things with the Turks are
solved.
And he's marching north, and he's actually engaged against the Austrian Elf Corps and the.
But that's part of the that's why Alexander cut a deal with the Turks too.
Yeah,
so he's
right.
Trying desperately to turn things around because remember, and this is important. There is no big battle before this. Napoleon is desperately trying to get a battle that he can use to defeat the Russian army, which he's confident he can do. And this is the battle he's been looking for. So when they finally deploy, and Davout is saying, let's flank them, and he's saying, just maneuver them out of that position, and they have done this rapport. I can't trap them. If they are willing to stand and take a beating, I am going to beat them into submission. And then I think Frank is right. As soon as he realized I can't see anything and I could be sending my guard into being destroyed for what? There's no guarantee that it's going to do the damage. But I want to go one step beyond that, is instead of like fine-tuning where the guard goes in, whether it goes in, things like that, what if? Okay, here's the next what if.
We didn't really answer your question.
Well, then the second part was, what's left in the Rebsky Redoubt?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. At that point, there is no one on the Russian side in there. Once it falls, and they are back to, what was it, Simas? What the hell is it?
Let me borrow your thing. By that time,
they're back. They're back here.
The key to their center position, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And when he's asking for that division to be thrown in, is right about the time. I'm going by memory here.
Sure.
But it's right about the time that like the 27th Division and those guys have kind of shredded.
Right.
And the Russians are bringing down, I think, Bagmatyev's guys, but they haven't gotten them down yet. And they're kind of marching down, and then the moment kind of passes, you know. So they finally get those troops in position and form this new reentrant. So the line ends up looking like it comes down to the Rayevsky Redoubt, and then it kind of hooks in here. they end up having troops here facing south, and then, and this is kind of filled in with the remnants of 5th Corps down in here, and whatever's left of Bagration's 2nd West Army. And it's these guys right here that once they form up, then the French kind of, they bring some of the guard artillery forward, and they pound them for a long time, and they take a lot of casualties, but they can never break those guys. That exact moment, I can't tell you. You know, I'd have to kind of go back and take a look. I can't tell you.
Those are kind of Schrodinger's caddy, too. You know, yeah. The only way to know who would have been there when Napoleon's guys got there is if he had sent them.
Right. Yes.
Does any of the information in the book actually answer some of the questions about what Russians might have been in those positions that they were trying to get Napoleon to?
No. And unfortunately, and the reason is... the book has the official orders and letters, and if somebody is remembering things, they're remembering where I was standing, the following happened, okay? And I did not see anything that answers that particular question. Remember also the casualties among officers at this point is huge. And part of the thing is, we don't know where the guard would have hit exactly, because remember, at Waterloo, we're almost out of time. Okay, we'll try to wrap this up. At Waterloo, you know, La Haye-Sainte falls, right, and then the guard goes forward. Had they just walked our march to the right from the French perspective and set it to the left into the foot guards that are in that sunken road, right, how history would have been changed there, right? Because now they're walking into the King's German Legion remnants that have been beaten to a pulp. Everything on that side has been just chewed, and there's really nothing because the horse guards, the cavalry are all done, right? So the guard at that point in the attack would have gone into a very weak portion of Wellington's line between what Wellington had formed and the Prussians trying to come in, as opposed to going into an area where they were stopped, okay? So this is where you don't know. And to me, it's a die roll, it's a card draw, whatever. I mean, and Napoleon knew this. It was not a guarantee, and that's why he didn't do it. It's like, why am I rolling the dice? Why am I rolling the dice with the young guard? I'm going to need them after this battle. Mm-hmm. Rolling the dice here is, yeah, maybe I could, like, hammer them. But, you know, it's not an academic question. This is not rhetorical. This is like, if I commit them, they're done, right? I've lost a big chunk of my guard, and I cannot make them again. So if they don't do what I want, you know, Frank is saying, I could die here in Russia, 1,000 leagues from Paris. So I think that is the deciding factor. But I want to go to the next what if. Once the smoke clears, okay, and the Russians are still standing there, right? The next day.
You mean if they don't retreat?
If they don't retreat that night, right? Because, again, they think, hey, we grabbed the fleshes and everything. I mean, one of the things that Kutuzov could have done was, I think he made the right decision, but there's always that chance that, you know, hey, we recaptured the territory. Yeah, we took heavy casualties, but you know what? I think he's in trouble, and we can stand here, and we'll you know, it's now who's going to blink? Now the question is, does Napoleon have enough, or are the Russians so badly beaten up that they are fragile enough, they just need one more hit on a second day of battle, that it could have cracked them seriously? You know, this is, again, no one's ever talked about this, but I'm curious, in your opinion, how realistic is it that Kutuzov would have ever gone with the decision to stand for another day?
I don't think he can stand. I mean, he's completely
part of why he withdrew was to not take that risk.
Right, he understands that, you know, the army can watch away, but it can't hardly fight there. They've really depleted their artillery ammunition. Both sides really depleted their artillery ammunition, but the Russians are relying on their artillery. They've lost so much infantry, they have to rely on their artillery. And the French recover something like 20 or 30,000 artillery rounds on the battlefield that I say they're still usable, which helps replenish
supply.
Right, I mean, you can get more powder. You make powder or find it. But, you know, they really shoot off an awful lot of artillery ammunition.
Right. So there's not... I don't see a reason that Kutuzov would have changed his mind
either. And the thing is, I think on that subject, Kutuzov is maybe the least realistic of the senior German Russian officers.
Yeah.
And if he thinks it's time to go, it's you can put that in the bag. You know?
Yes. All right. With that, if there are no more questions, what I'd like to say is, if anyone is interested in finding out when I do the Kickstarter for the book, please give me your email address. I'd be very happy to let you know when we start this. Frank, thank you so much for your thoughts. And thank you all for being here. And I want to